Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this program, we visit with Julian Schnabel, the director of a movie called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, a truly incredible story that's true. We begin when I ask Julian Schnabel to describe the book, Blinked, by Jean-Dominique Balbi, on which the movie is based.
The book was made by a man who had been the editor of French Elle magazine, and when he was 42 years old, he had a massive stroke. He woke up in a hospital in the north part of Calais, in a town called Berck, and when he woke up, basically ended up with one left eye that he could blink. And they devised an alphabet out of the letters that were most frequently the frequency of use in the French language, and when they would arrive at that letter, he would blink. And with this technique, he actually blinked this book. This wasn't designed because he was going to write a book. This was just designed so he could communicate. The fact was that he was a writer, and he had a contract to write a book before his attack. And he described his paralyzation as a diving bell, and the way that he could escape that diving bell was through the writing of this book, and that's what the movie's about. He essentially notices that there are two things that are not paralyzed besides his left eye, and those things are his imagination and his memory. And so he says that he can imagine anything, and he can be with the women that he loved, and he could go anywhere, any place, time travel, and essentially, as a filmmaker, I could put anything I want into the movie. And so it was, this man was reporting back from a state that was somewhere between life and death, and he had enough time to revisit his life in 2020 retrospect vision.
So how do you craft this into a movie?
I want you to know that you're the only person that I've talked to that's not seen this movie. And normally, I only talk to people that have seen the film. But I guess I like the sound of your voice, and I thought, oh, what the hell? I've been doing this for such a long time that doesn't matter anymore. I'll accept anybody that's curious about it, I will talk to. Maybe that's method radio casting that you're doing, like the way I do my method directing. So you wanted to be like those people so you'd have a fresh, unknowing question to ask. One thing I learned making this movie is that right now you and me are connected in our consciousness, and maybe, you know, it's a telephone that's doing that, but I hear your voice in my head and you hear my voice in your head, and when we hang up later, you'll hear my voice in your head, because it was in your head. If you feel like it, it'll be part of your catalog of memories in a way, and I think that this man was accessing these kinds of things. Now, was it really there? Yeah, it's there if they imagine it, and they can see it as clearly because they're, you know, they've remembered seeing one of those buildings somewhere. And once you start realizing that you can't walk out of a room, that you can't move any of your limbs, and that you have to live inside of your head, those images start to take on another kind of gravity, or another kind of, they become a physical reality, and I think that it's almost incomprehensible the kind of commitment that this man had to have to actually keep going, and also blink this book into existence, because I don't know if it took 500,000 blinks to make the book, but it's a very arduous process. Essentially, he compared the prison of his body to this diving bell that was the fact is that Matthew Almerich, who played the main character, I actually went underwater with him, and he was in this diving bell. And I got to tell you, it is a medieval torture chamber. I mean, I could not go in there.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Julian Schnabel, the director of the movie The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which is the story of Jean-Dominique Balbi, the editor of Elle magazine, who had a stroke that locked him into his body. The only movement that he could make was that of his left eye. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The book that was blinked by Jean-Dominique Balbi has been recorded in an audio version read by René Auberginois. I'd like to play a portion of that book now so that you get a sense of what it was like and the words of Jean-Dominique Balbi.
In my case, blinking my left eyelid is my only means of communication. Of course, the party chiefly concerned is the last to hear the good news. I myself had 20 days of deep coma and several weeks of grogginess and somnolence before I truly appreciated the extent of the damage. I did not fully awake until the end of January. When I finally surfaced, I was in room 119 of the Naval Hospital at Berck-sur-Mer on the French Channel coast. The same room, 119, infused now with the first light of day from which I write. An ordinary day. At 7, the chapel bells begin again to punctuate the passage of time, quarter hour by quarter hour. After their night's respite, my congested bronchial tubes once more begin their noisy rattle. My hands, lying curled on the yellow sheets, are hurting, although I can't tell if they're burning hot or ice cold. To fight off stiffness, I instinctively stretch my arms and legs, moving only a fraction of an inch. It is often enough to bring relief to a painful limb. My diving bell becomes less oppressive, and my mind takes flight like a butterfly. There is so much to do. You can wander off in space or in time, set out for Tierra del Fuego, or for King Midas's court. You can visit the woman you love, slide down beside her, and stroke her still sleeping face. Enough. My main task now is to compose the first of these bedridden travel notes so that I shall be ready when my publisher's emissary arrives to take my dictation letter by letter. In my head, I churn over every sentence 10 times, delete a word, add an adjective, and learn my text by heart, paragraph by paragraph. 7:30. The duty nurse interrupts the flow of my thoughts. Following a well-established ritual, she draws the curtain, checks tracheostomy and drip feed, and turns on the TV so I can watch the news. Right now, a cartoon celebrates the adventures of the fastest frog in the West. And what if I ask to be changed into a frog? What then? The wheelchair. I had never seen so many white coats in my little room. Nurses, orderlies, physical therapists, occupational therapists, psychologists, neurologists, interns, and even the department head. The whole hospital had turned out for the event. When they first burst in, pushing the conveyance ahead of them, I thought it meant that I was being ejected to make room for a new patient. I had already been at Berck a few weeks and was daily drawing nearer to the shores of awareness, but I still could not imagine any connection between a wheelchair and me. No one had yet given me an accurate picture of my situation, and I clung to the certainty, based on bits and pieces I had overheard, that I would very quickly recover movement and speech. Indeed, my roving mind was busy with 1,000 projects. A novel, travel, a play, marketing a fruit cocktail of my own invention. Don't ask for the recipe, I have forgotten it. They immediately dressed me. Good for the morale, pronounced the neurologist in sententious tones. And in truth, I would have been pleased to trade my yellow nylon hospital gown for a plaid shirt, old pants, and a shapeless sweater, except that it was a nightmare to put them on. or rather to watch the clothes manipulated after endless contortions over these uncooperative deadweight limbs, which served me only as a source of pain. When I was finally dressed, the ritual could begin. Two attendants seized me by the shoulders and feet, lifted me off the bed, and dumped me unceremoniously in the wheelchair. I had graduated from being a patient whose prognosis was uncertain to an official quadriplegic. They didn't quite applaud, but they came close. My caretakers made me travel the length and breadth of the hospital floor to make certain that the seated position did not trigger uncontrollable spasms, but I was too devastated by this brutal downgrading of my future hopes to take much notice. They had to place a special cushion behind my head. It was wobbling about like the head of one of those African women upon removal of the stack of rings that has been stretching her neck for years. "You can handle the wheelchair," said the occupational therapist with a smile intended to make the remark sound like good news, whereas to my ears it had the ring of a life sentence. In one flash I saw the frightening truth. It was blinding as an atomic explosion and keener than a guillotine blade. They all left. As three orderlies laid me back down, I thought of movie gangsters struggling to fit the slain informer's body into the trunk of their car. The wheelchair sat abandoned in a corner with my clothes tossed over its dark blue plastic backrest. Before the last white coat left the room, I signaled my wish to have the TV turned on low. On the screen was my father's favorite quiz show. Since daybreak, an unremitting drizzle had been streaking my windows. Prayer. Oddly enough, the shock of the wheelchair was helpful. Things became clearer. I gave up my grandiose plans, and the friends who had built a barrier of affection around me since my catastrophe were able to talk freely. With the subject no longer taboo, we began to discuss locked-in syndrome. First of all, it is very rare. It is small consolation, but the chances of being caught in this hellish trap are about as likely as those of winning the lottery. At Berk, only two of us were locked in, and my own case was not classic. I am able to swivel my head, which is not supposed to be part of the clinical picture. Since most victims are relegated to a vegetable existence, the evolution of the disease is not well understood. All that is known is that if the nervous system makes up its mind to start working again, it does so at the speed of a hair growing from the base of the brain. So it is likely that several years will go by before I can expect to wiggle my toes. In fact, it is in my respiratory passages that I can hope for improvement. In the long term, I can hope to eat more normally, that is, without the help of a gastric tube. Eventually, perhaps I will be able to breathe naturally without a respirator and muster enough breath to make my vocal cords vibrate. But for now, I would be the happiest of men if I could just swallow the overflow of saliva that endlessly floods my mouth. Even before first light, I am already practicing sliding my tongue toward the rear of my palate in order to provoke a swallowing reaction. What is more, I have dedicated to my larynx the little packets of incense hanging on the wall, amulets brought back from Japan by pious globe-trotting friends. Just one of the stones in the Thanksgiving monument erected by my circle of friends during their wanderings. In every corner of the world, the most diverse deities have been solicited in my name. I try to organize all this spiritual energy. If they tell me that candles have been burned for my sake in a Breton chapel, or a mantra has been chanted in a Nepalese temple, I at once give each of the spirits invoked a precise task. A woman I know enlisted a Cameroon holy man to procure me the goodwill of Africa's gods. I have assigned him my right eye. For my hearing problems, I rely on the relationship between my devout mother-in-law and the monks of a Bordeaux brotherhood. They regularly dedicate their prayers to me, and I occasionally steal into their abbey to hear their chants fly heavenward. So far the results have been unremarkable. But when seven brothers of the same order had their throats cut by Islamic fanatics, my ears hurt for several days. Yet all these lofty protections are merely clay ramparts. walls of sand, Maginot lines compared to the small prayer my daughter Celeste sends up to her Lord every evening before she closes her eyes. Since we fall asleep at roughly the same hour, I set out for the kingdom of slumber with this wonderful talisman which shields me from all harm. Bath time. At 8:30, the physical therapist arrives. Brigitte, a woman with an athletic figure and an Imperial Roman profile, has come to exercise my stiffened arms and legs. They call the exercise mobilization, a term whose martial connotations contrast ludicrously with the paltry forces thus summoned, for I've lost 66 pounds in just 20 weeks. When I began a diet a week before my stroke, I never dreamed of such a dramatic result. As she works, Brigitte checks for the smallest flicker of improvement. "Try to squeeze my hand," she asks. Since I sometimes have the illusion that I am moving my fingers, I focus my energy on crushing her knuckles. But nothing stirs, and she replaces my inert hand on its foam pad. In fact, the only sign of change is in my neck. I can now turn my head 90 degrees, and my field of vision extends from the slate roof of the building next door to the curious tongue-lolling Mickey Mouse drawn by my son Théophile when I am still unable to open my mouth. Now, after regular exercise, we have reached the stage of slipping a lollipop into it. As the neurologist says, we need to be very patient. The session with Brigitte ends with a facial massage. Her warm fingers travel all over my face, including the numb zone, which seems to me to have the texture of parchment, and the area that still has feeling where I can manage the beginnings of a frown. Since the demarcation line runs across my mouth, I can only half smile, which fairly faithfully reflects my ups and downs. A domestic event as commonplace as washing can trigger the most varied emotions. One day, for example, I can find it amusing, in my 45th year, to be cleaned up and turned over, to have my bottom wiped and swaddled like a newborn's. I even derive a guilty pleasure from this total lapse into infancy. But the next day, the same procedure seems to me unbearably sad, and a tear rolls down through the lather a nurse's aid spreads over my cheeks. And my weekly bath plunges me simultaneously into distress and happiness. The delectable moment when I sink into the tub is quickly followed by nostalgia for the protracted immersions that were the joy of my previous life. Armed with a cup of tea or a scotch, a good book or a pile of newspapers, I would soak for hours, maneuvering the taps with my toes. Rarely do I feel my condition so cruelly as when I am recalling such pleasures. Luckily, I have no time for gloomy thoughts. Already they are wheeling me back, shivering to my room, on a gurney as comfortable as a bed of nails. I must be fully dressed by 10:30 and ready to go to the rehabilitation center. Having turned down the hideous jogging suit provided by the hospital, I am now attired as I was in my student days. Like the bath, my old clothes could easily bring back poignant, painful memories. But I see in the clothing a symbol of continuing life and proof that I still want to be myself. If I must drool, I may as well drool on cashmere.
We have just heard a portion of the book, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly by Jean-Dominique Balbi, as read by René Aubergenois. And now we continue with our interview with Julian Schnabel, the director of the movie with the same name as the book. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Julian, tell us about the days of Jean-Dominique Balbi.
He gets up at 5 o'clock every morning, thinks about what he's going to write, and then blinks it into existence from 8 till he stops working, and then starts the next day. But this was his way of leaving the diving bell, and he described this as his butterfly. So he became the point of view of a butterfly, and with that he was able to go anywhere. He saw ecosystems falling apart. He saw Egypt. He went to he surfed at Banzai Pipeline, or he was a bullfighter. He could do whatever the hell he wanted to do. And somehow, by transmuting his experience into this book, he transgressed death. And essentially, the act of making art is a denial of death, because life contains death, but art doesn't. So it is life-affirming. And essentially, when he transposes his whole problem into this book, at a certain moment, the sound goes out of the movie, and you hear this other person's voice, who was the woman who was transcribing his thoughts, says, I had one last thought. We're going to be late for the theater. Then I sank into a coma. And you realize at that moment that he has passed the baton. This is before he actually wakes up at the hospital. But I'm not going to tell you more about that right now, because I would like you just to, you'll see where everything is when you see the film.
What sources did you have to learn about Jean-Dominique Bauby other than his book?
Well, I went to the hospital where he was a patient, and I lived there. And I shot the movie in that hospital with his nurses and his physiotherapist. And
the same ones who attended him?
Absolutely. And I learned French to make the movie, because the movie is in French. And I met the mother of his children and his girlfriend and his best friend, Anne-Marie Perrier and Bernard Chapuis, who essentially his best friend is a hybrid character played by Isaac de Bancolet. So I went there like a detective to try to find out as much as I could about my subject.
An old friend of mine once commented when she heard this story, "This would make me absolutely crazy if it happened to me." What kind of a person do you think Jean-Dominique was that opened up the world to him?
Well, I think it did make him crazy. And he had a choice of either going mad or solving his problem. And I think when you see the movie, you'll kind of feel that insanity at some moment, and the fear of that, and the kind of desperate solution. Necessity is the mother of invention.
And he had no choice.
No choice.
Well, tell us about what other films you would like to make if you had full freedom to do so.
I have been extremely privileged in that sense. There's a lot of things. I will never make all the movies that I would like to make. I thought that the book Legs by Bill Kennedy would make a fine movie. I thought the book You Can't Win by Jack Black, who was a career criminal and wrote this book in 1926, would make a fine movie. The Secret Life of the Lonely Doll, The Kidnapping of Edgardo Mortara, there's a bunch of things.
Are there topics other than books?
Well, it's really not about the book. It's about what the books are about. The fact is that the film Basquiat that I made did not come from a book. I actually made a movie about Lou Reed that did not come from a book. It's not out yet, but it had to do with a record that he made in 1973 called Berlin. And it was a huge failure when he made the book, and he didn't play that record live until this past December with the original guitar player Steve Hunter and Bob Ezrin, who was the musical director of and producer of that record originally, and Hal Wilner. And so Lou asked me if I would direct this, and my daughter Lola shot footage of Emmanuel Seigner in New York City during the Halloween parade, and there are other films of hers that were used in telling this story. And so there's a couple of other ways I approach making a movie that don't necessarily come from books. But I think what I try to do in the films that I make is address something that needs to be addressed, that I feel that only I could sort of do. So they don't really need me to make a movie like, say, American Gangster. But I think they probably would need me to see The Diving Bell and the Butterfly made. There's a lot of translating that goes on in movies. I mean, it's different than painting. You know, I'm a painter, basically, and painting is like playing the saxophone. You just hit a note, and there it is. There's no explanation. There is no translating. When you're making a movie, you're usually translating maybe a book into a script and translating the script into a physical fact, which is the day-to-day activities that comprise the filmmaking and recording of these activities and translating that information to actors so they then make that seem, or they turn that into a physical recorded fact that approximates essentially your version of what the story might be. But
so how does that translation occur?
Step by step.
Are there any theories or formulas that you, over the years, have found that work better than others?
Yeah. I don't rehearse. I spend a lot of time with the actors, but not necessarily rehearsing what they're going to do, more like getting to know them, and they get to know me, so there's a level of trust that exists, and they'll do what I ask them to do. I usually shoot the rehearsals. I always shoot the rehearsals. I don't want to see somebody do something and then ask somebody to shoot it and say, can you do that again? So I try to keep everything as spontaneous as possible and keep myself open to the accident or the last thought I might have right before I shoot something. Is that a formula? I don't know. It's sort of just an attitude.
How did you land upon that attitude as a way of making movies?
Probably because I'm a painter and I don't really... It's almost as if I would take everything that I've... my preparation and just sort of get everything in one place and then lean towards the divine light and throw the script out the window.
So are you implying that you never went to cinematography school? You just kind of picked it up?
I never did go to film school, no. Since you're taping this and you have a moment, if you go to see The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, I'd love for you in 2020 retrospect vision talk about what you saw. I'd love to hear what you had to say about it, just from my own selfish kind of curiosity.
Well, I can let you know.
Okay, beautiful.
Well, Julian Schnabel, tell me about an interesting book that you've read lately.
There's a woman that wrote a book about Palestinian women that were growing up in the Israeli state, and I think that there's something in there that's a movie that I feel like making. It's called Miral.
Julian Schnabel, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Good luck, man.
Julian Schnabel is the director of the movie The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, a memoir by Jean-Dominique Baubé, written by blinking his eye, the only part of his body he could move. The book that Julian Schnabel recommends is Miral, a book which he hopes to use as the basis for a movie. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.